The following program from the North Carolina Reading Service is presented for our blind and print-impaired listeners. It is the Indie Week, and it's read by John Federson. Our issue this week, dated September 1st, 2021. And we have a... Of course, you can tell we have a special treat for listeners of music. For our, instead of our regular theme of music, we've invited a piano virtuoso today, Giuseppe Grampausa. He used to be performing, and he is performing, a famous work by the American composer John Cage. It was composed in 1952. I'll give you a few moments. It's titled 4 minutes, 33 seconds. We are experiencing it right now, and we will fade that out, and we'll ask Grampausa to repeat as much of it as possible when we close our program. All right, as we fade our classical music down for the time, we go to our op-ed page, the first article in Indie Week by Jennifer Holt called Time for Change. Few Quaverinas black residents have asked the town's elected officials to make structural changes to little response. Earlier this year, a group of engaged citizens formed a Few Quaverina Community Alliance to advocate for increasing the social, political, and economic well-being of Few Quaverinas black residents. During the group's initial meetings, members identified multiple issues and prioritized making a request for a cultural assessment of municipal government as a first step toward meaningful change. When in early April the Board of Commissioners voted to suspend the activity of the town's Public Safety Committee, Alliance member Jovita Simons wrote to town leaders expressing her dismay. Town manager Adam Mitchell offered Ms. Simons and other Alliance members an audience with the town's elected officials, and as many saw it, an opportunity to advocate for a cultural assessment. In conversations with Mitchell and the commissioners, the Alliance emphasized that the culture of a municipality is more than just a matter of policing. It includes, among other issues, the town's efforts regarding public safety, community engagement, housing equity, education, economic development, access to health care, transportation, and overall transparency. At Board of Commissioners meetings since last April, Alliance members have used the public comment period to bring forward a three-pronged request for assessment. The group requests that an independent entity conduct a cultural assessment of municipal government, that the town make public the entire assessment report, and that the town then engage an independent consultant to analyze, make recommendations, and manage the outcomes of that assessment. At first, commissioners seemed to meet these requests with strong support. From a series of private meetings with Mitchell and elected officials, Alliance members understood that Mitchell would research independent assessment providers, that all commissioners supported assessment, and that, according to Mayor Pro Tem Blake Messingill, conducting an assessment was not a matter of if, but when. Alliance members believed they were moving in a positive direction, but those feelings of hopefulness were short-lived. At a June meeting with Manager Mitchell and Mayor John Byrne, the Alliance learned that Mitchell was not prepared to recommend an assessment and would instead recommend creating a diversity, equity, and inclusion position within town government. Although Alliance members believed that a DEI hire could do some good, they pointed out the stark difference between acquiring DEI personnel and conducting a cultural assessment. The one is in no way a sufficient substitute for the other, and the recommendation of the one in the absence of the other was a significant blow. Alliance members noted that the purpose of all meetings with town officials was to get a commitment to have a cultural assessment completed by an independent entity in the very near future. The Alliance launched an online petition to renew its ask and gather community support. Members who spoke at commissioners' meetings in July argued for separating the DEI hire from conducting an assessment, noting that completing an assessment prior to hiring DEI personnel would impart important benefits. The August 2nd Board of Commissioners meeting stands out among recent public events that raise questions about the town's willingness to engage a citizen-led group requesting concrete data about the town's overall culture. At that meeting, Commissioner William Harris made a motion in support of conducting a cultural assessment. Though the other commissioners had each expressed their support in private meetings with the Alliance, none of them seconded Harris's motion. None of those commissioners, the mayor or the town manager, have engaged in conversation with members of the Alliance since the June meeting, when Mitchell said he would not recommend going forward with assessments. Ms. Simons has not given up hope. At the August 2nd meeting, she noted the absence of nearly all elected and appointed officials' public engagement on the matter. Quote, "Did you even hear the cry? I'm sure there have been discussions privately, but nothing in this forum where the citizens of the town can hear the concerns or issues at hand." She emphasized that her family has called Fuquay Varina home for three generations, and now is the time to address systemic racism. "Get the facts on the table," she proposed, "and let's move forward together from there." As of the August town board meetings, the official line is, "Now is not the time." Or, as Mayor Byrne put it, "I believe that we will move forward. I'm not sure it'll be at the speed that everybody wants. I believe we are in a process now, and I have a lot of confidence in our town team here that we'll get it done. We'll get there." One wonders about comments like the mayor's that address the requests of citizen advocacy groups by indefinitely postponing any concrete actions that might directly address those requests. In Fuquay Varina, as in many small towns, those with power are selling the idea of progress via diversity and inclusion initiatives without taking necessary steps toward fundamental changes that would benefit the very residents who are requesting them. As a result, marginalized groups are still expected to be thankful for whatever quasi-benevolent offerings are made to them by people in power, unaccustomed to making genuine concessions. In an election season that will result in a new mayor for the first time in 20 years and several new commissioners, residents should be wary of candidate narratives about progress that ultimately substitute well-articulated plans for actual structural change. In November, the citizens of Fuquay Varina will choose between candidates who uphold the status quo and those whose actions indicate that they are, in fact, listening to the community they're sworn to serve. This column by Jennifer Holt is listed as an op-ed, Time for Change. Now we will return to part three of a long article about Lincoln High School, Chapel Hill Carborough's segregated Lincoln High School in the 60s. And part one, Shown Delight and the Mighty Tigers football team. Part two tells of the movement's second wave in the 63 and 64 and outlines mismanaged integration that has led to one of the largest achievement gaps in the country between white students and students of color. This is part three, Shouldering the Struggle, and is written by Joel Srantz. This series opens with a claim that the Lincoln students' movements for civil rights rattled the town's status quo, reverberated through the state and echoed out across the country. It's no far-reaching exaggeration. Many of the struggle's protagonists lived lives worthy of novels as they carried the lessons and leadership of the local movement out into the world. Fred Battle was one. Danita Mason Hogan's, daughter of Lincoln graduate Dave Mason Jr., knows his story well. She calls Fred Battle one of her dearest mentors. Like Fred Baldwin, the Mighty Tigers quarterback featured in Parts 1 and 2, Battle, received a college football scholarship thanks to his success at Lincoln. He went on to play at NCA&T after graduation. Mason Hogan says of how he managed the symbiotic connection between activism and football, he used some of that strategy that he learned in Chapel Hill and brought it to A&T, which was also a huge activist community. We have people like Lincoln graduates Betty Baldwin and Juanita Alston, who also went to A&T, and they talk about how they were marching. The football players would flank them. They would get in a formation, and it was the role of football players to make sure that the people inside the formation were protected. And that's nothing but a football move. By Battle's side, on the field and in the streets, was his A&T football teammate, Jesse. Now, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, Sr. Like Fred Battle, Mighty Tigers quarterback and Chapel Hill 9 leader Harold Foster continued movement work long after Lincoln. He became the first ever editor-in-chief of a newspaper at North Carolina College, now NC Central University, who wasn't a senior. He then moved to New York City to work with Stokely Carmichael, who would become the chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. Because of his activism, Foster had been invited to SNCC's founding in 1960, while he was still a senior at Lincoln. Later, Foster refused the draft for the Vietnam War and was sentenced to prison for 2 years. Mason Hogan's father, Dave Mason Jr., says that even behind bars, Foster was active, teaching some of the prisoners how to read. Others who led the movement that arose from Lincoln continue to influence Chapel Hill Carborough to this day. Until recently, Braxton Fouché volunteered at Culbreth Middle School, helping Burmese and Karen students learn English as a second language. Sitting with me at Weaver Street Market in Carborough, Fouché makes an important connection between Lincoln students and today's young people. He says, "I was always encouraging and telling those kids, I know you're in a strange country, but there are people out here that would lead you in the right way. If there's somebody bothering you, you let me know, because I don't want you to go through the same thing that we had to go through." This has been a football story, offering a specific lens through which to view the history of Lincoln High, but young Lincoln women played roles that rivaled those of the young men. Fred Baldwin's sister, Betty Baldwin Gear, is one. A star on Lincoln High School girls' basketball team, Betty surpassed Fred in her leadership in the students' fight for civil rights. Like Battle and Foster, she carried this leadership with her. At North Carolina A&T, Betty was more than once arrested with Fred Battle and Jesse Jackson during that desegregation movement in Greensboro in the early 1960s. During one action in the summer, so many hundreds of students were arrested that the police took them to farmhouses in the country to detain them. Betty led a chorus of young women singing, "We Shall Overcome," in steadfast defiance as others around them fainted from the heat. Dolores Bynum, another Lincoln graduate, married her high school sweetheart, a Mighty Tigers football player. After graduation, she worked at Lenore Dining Hall on UNC's campus and took part in the cafeteria's workers' strike in 1969 that won a higher minimum wage for state employees all across North Carolina. The legacy of these women stays with Danita Mason Hogans. She tells me, "I really believe in intergenerational organizing. There are so many things we can learn from people who came before us. Not just stories of grandeur, but strategic efforts. There's a lot that elders can impart to young people." While elders have wisdom from their experience, she says they too need to recognize when to pass the torch. She explains, "My admonition would be that older people need to get out of young people's way. Young people have always represented the very best of change, and I think that older people have a tendency to hold on to power and stifle them, because young people are always at the center of change, but they're very rarely at the center of power." She recognizes this change-making in the Black and Brown Student Coalition, BBSC, a group that students at Carborough High School founded last summer, and how that effort connects to the Lincoln students' work. She says the BBSC is a really good example of young people who are willing to outwardly question what's going on and question the system. And so in that way, they're very much connected to Lincoln High School. In late July, I stopped by Al's Burger Shack in Chapel Hill's Southern Village. A young man named Phoenix Garayua Tudrin came around from his station on the kitchen line. We talk outside on his break. When Garayua Tudrin was a kid, his father, who is Puerto Rican, moved the family from Florida to Carrboro to become the first football coach for the new Carrboro High School Jaguars. Garayua Tudrin has been around the Jaguars most of his life, and in high school he became one of them. He played quarterback, wide receiver, and linebacker until he graduated earlier this year. Last summer, Garayua Tudrin was a founding member of the BBSC. For him, the necessity of an organization led by students of color was overdue. Not only do students of color at Carrboro High face some of the worst achievement gaps in the country when compared with their white peers, but many also felt that their voices weren't being heard. He tells me, there was always that lack of student voice, especially black and brown student voice. It was usually dominated by our white, richer population. We felt like there was a need for a group that could facilitate conversations between students and that could actually make change in our community and in our schools. The decision for it to be a black and brown coalition was important to Garayua Tudrin. He says, a lot of times in our community, and really in a lot of communities, discrimination and oppression separate our groups, try to put each group against each other. We wanted to make sure it was a unified front instead of separating people, because everything that we were trying to do is to bring people together, even our white students. One of the BBSC's leaders this year, Sophia Rangel, a junior at Carrboro, agrees. She says in an email, having the black and brown student coalition is so important because it creates a sense of unity that we need to combat systems of oppression together. For her, whether or not to join the BBSC was never a question, and she explains, growing up, I have always been surrounded by activism of some kind. My mom was an ESL teacher who was really active in advocating for the deferred action for childhood arrival students. My dad is an immigrant, and so I was always aware of the obstacles that came with that identity. Because of this, I knew that I wanted to advocate for marginalized voices, including my own, and BBSC was just that. Leading beside Rangel this year is a senior named Walker Robinson. Like Garayua Tudrin and like Fred Baldwin, Fred Battle, Harold Foster, Braxton Fouché, and many others, Robinson also leads the football team that lines up on a gridiron in Carrboro. The day after I met with Garayua Tudrin, I went back to Southern Village. Robinson just finished a dishwashing shift at Town Hall Grill on the other side of the Southern Village Green, and we sit down outside. Robinson says he remembered that when Garayua Tudrin approached him about the BBSC, he knew he wanted to join. As he alludes to the discrepancies at Carrboro High, Robinson also points to how history is taught in our schools and how that teaching can be a detriment to social justice. He says, everything that I knew about the civil rights movement, I learned from my parents. I didn't learn anything about what really happened during those times from school until this past year when I took a class that I really had to go out of my way to take. But the BBSC is changing that. Robinson says the group is working to add both a black and Latinx history class to the high school's curricula. And the BBSC has already made an impact in another realm. More than 60 years after Fred Baldwin and Jimmy Weaver snuck under a tin fence to watch football games for which they couldn't afford admission, ticket prices are still an issue for students and community members of color in Carrboro, and the BBSC tackled that head on. Gwaryua Tudrin explains one of the things we talked about last year was making games free for all students, taking that cost out. And we were actually able to do that. Usually they'd make students pay, and that made no sense to us because it added an economic barrier. So it's going to be all free next year for Carrboro students. As he looks to the future, Gwaryua Tudrin, now a student at UNC Chapel Hill, has a sober perspective. He says, I'm extremely privileged and honored to be in this town because there's so much history with everybody that's been an activist growing up, especially that Lincoln High football team just setting that example. But I think we still have a long way to go. And there's a lot that needs to be done, and there's a lot that people need to process within themselves about what they're supporting and what their support means. Despite the long road ahead, Gwaryua Tudrin is aware of the great steps the BBSC has taken and how it will benefit those engaged in the future. He says, our project spread around to the colleges. UNC was using the BBSC podcast in their School of Education, and I think Duke was doing the same. So I feel like just that community that we built and that structure, the foundation, is going to make it really easy to help out in the future. Like Mason Hodges, even Gwaryua Tudrin at age 18 understands that when it comes to the BBSC and student-led movements, he needs to step back. As with mighty tigers of old, passing the baton from one generation to the next, Gwaryua Tudrin will continue to support his former football team, as well as the social justice movement to which he contributed a great deal. But just as he can no longer take the field in a Jaguars jersey, his involvement in the BBSC won't be from a leadership position anymore, he says. I kind of also don't want to be too involved because it's theirs now. They have different goals. They have different experiences. So you got to value that and just let them move forward. And move forward they will, mightily. Next, Buried History by Tomasi McDonald. Old abandoned African-American cemeteries that were created before and after slaveries are archives, not unlike museums, says North Carolina Central University history professor Charles Johnson. He told the Indy last week, they hold a treasure trove of our experiences and our history, not just for who is interned there, but the means of burial. It was not uncommon for African Americans who were not literate during post-emancipation to use crude carving instruments to make tombstones out of field stones. These cemeteries give us an opportunity to honor our ancestors and treat them in death in ways they were not treated in life. Johnson notes the current quest by Black Americans to connect with family is not unlike the post-Reconstruction period when newly freed men and women wanted to be buried at gravesites in named plots next to family members in unmarked plots. There's a great deal of sanctity with this. Johnson has partnered with Duke University and historic Stagville for a study, Reckoning with the Dead, the Durham Black Burial Grounds Collaboratory. His commentary came to mind last week after the discovery of the old Holman Family Cemetery, an abandoned, long-neglected parcel that sits on the edge of Black Meadow Ridge in North Durham's Horton Hills community in the Argonne Hills subdivision. The modest cemetery has a handful of extant tombstones, including one for Seal Hall, who was born in 1800 and died in 1891, along with a second one propped against a tree that states Lonnie Holman was born in 1867 and died in 1925. Nicholas Levy, Vice President of Preservation Durham, knew that patch of sacred ground. Levy and Preservation Durham's board president, Tom Miller, visited the family cemetery in early August and stuck 68 small orange flags in the ground to mark potential grave sites. After determining the tombstones and other grave markers were part of a, quote, much larger patterned area, including dozens of field stones and grave depressions. In an email to the Indy, Levy says property records and other documents confirm that the cemetery was part of an expansive 88-acre tract owned by Dilsey, a black woman who purchased the land in the late 1870s. In noting its importance, Levy adds that the grave sites will help scholars, historians, and the general public better understand the early post-Civil War reconfiguration of communities around the Eno River. Johnson says that there are at least 30 old black cemeteries in various states of condition scattered throughout Durham and the surrounding region that were established during slavery and the post-emancipation period. He says a couple are historically significant. Johnson says many of the burial grounds sit on hills to symbolize Calvary or Golgotha and are established near rivers to symbolize the biblical significance of the Jordan River. One of the more intriguing black burial grounds is the Johnson Family Cemetery, tucked away in Duke Forest, near the border of Durham and Orange counties. The cemetery sits on a hill surrounded by oak, pine, and hickory trees. The site, now the property of a neighborhood homeowners association, was originally owned by Charles William Johnston, who started the Green Hill Plantation after he received a land grant from the King of England in 1750. Enslaved people dating back to the 1700s were allowed to bury their loved ones on the plot of land. The last known burial happened in 1959. The descendants of those interred at the cemetery could not be reached for comment, but the website, named johnsondescendants.tribalpages.com, provides a wealth of information. The website notes, for instance, that the Bible of Fanny Moore lists the names of the enslaved people buried at the site. The two oldest recorded burials were for David, who was born in 1781, and Rachel, born a decade later, 1791. Susan Johnston Sellers, a descendant of the Johnston plantation owners, wants to restore the burial ground with help from the state, telling the Indy, "It's the sad heritage of my family and others that this cemetery has been completely forgotten." After returning to the area several years ago, she has encouraged her neighbors to support efforts to preserve the burial ground. She explained that although the place is formerly known as the Johnston Cemetery, the formerly enslaved on the Green Hill Plantation dropped the letter T after emancipation. The ancient cemetery is laid out in lined rows of tombstones, granite, and quartz rocks. The quiet burial ground is a testament to a people who, after being stolen from themselves, reclaimed and honored their lives in death. Near the cemetery entrance, there appear to be remnants of an outdoor church, where ancient lichen-covered rocks with smooth surfaces may have served as worship pews. The tombstones and fieldstone markers range in size from a massive anvil-shaped rock that sits next to an unlikely statue of a Hindu deity, to a quartz rock less than 10 inches long and 2 inches wide, embedded in the pine straw-covered ground. Sellers' neighbor, Lindsay Wilkes, on Sunday pointed to trees near depressions in the grounds. She has since learned that the trees may have served as grave markers. Wilkes says sometime they would bury around the tree for an entire family. Sellers adds, "A cemetery census says there are 144 graves there, but I think there are at least 200. My great-grandfather's will left 1.15 acres to the cemetery's descendants, but it was never honored." Jackie Johnson Sheehan, a Johnson Cemetery descendant who maintains the website about the history of the burial ground, says, "We are exploring the possibility that the transfer of ownership of the cemetery to an HOA may not have been proper or legal." In an email to Indy, Shaheen said that many of the descendants live in the Triangle because their ancestors remained in the area after emancipation. The Black Burial Grounds descendants include several pioneers. Stanley Vickers was the first Black student to attend Carrboro Chapel Hill Public Schools. Civil rights activist and decorated military veteran Jim Merritt was the first Black person to serve on the Chapel Hill Town Council, and Andre Leon Talley, the fashion maven, author, and journalist, is a creative and former fashion director with Vogue magazine. Sellers, Wilkes, and their neighbors' plans to preserve the cemetery are mirrored by the supporters of the Holman Family Cemetery and at all the Black burial grounds throughout the region. And Levy says, "We need to preserve this place out of respect for the humanity of those buried there, out of appreciation for the all-too-rare window it opens onto part of our shared past, and out of dedication to be better stewards of Durham history, particularly Black history, going forward." Yangxi Zhu, originally published in North Carolina Policy Watch, writes this: "The next crisis. Hundreds of thousands of North Carolina households behind on rent lost an important legal protection when the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the eviction moratorium on last Thursday, issued by the Centers for Disease Control in a 6-3 decision. The CDC stay on eviction, first issued by the Trump administration in September of 2020, was extended multiple times to expire at the end of July. On June 29th, Justice Brett Kavanaugh became the pivotal vote in the 5-4 decision to let the moratorium run its course, denying the plaintiff Alabama Association of Realtors' motion for emergency relief. As Policy Watch previously reported, Kavanaugh said the CDC exceeded its existing statutory authority by issuing a nationwide moratorium, yet he spared the federal rule, given that it was about to end in a month, to allow for the distribution of rental relief funds, he explained. However, the CDC issued another eviction moratorium for 2 months, starting August 3rd, that halts evictions in areas with, quote, substantial and high levels of community transmission levels of the coronavirus. The plaintiffs came back with a new challenge, again green-lighted by the D.C. District Court, and then sought an emergency injunction from the Supreme Court against the CDC order. This time, Kavanaugh and his colleague, Chief Justice John Roberts, joined the four justices who previously ruled in favor of the plaintiffs. The majority wrote in the opinion, "Apart from slightly narrowing the geographic scope, the new moratorium is indistinguishable from the old." However, the six justices reasoned that there was a need to vacate the moratorium, considering the votes in the previous case and the situation across the country. The opinion reads, quote, "Equities had shifted in the plaintiff's favor. Vaccine and rental assistance distribution had improved since the stay was entered, while the harm to landlords has continued to increase." The six justices nominated by Republican presidents, including three nominated by Trump, took a narrow interpretation of the CDC authority granted by the Public Health Service Act to say its authority relates more to regulating quarantines and imports. They also said the moratorium interferes with landlord-tenant laws within purview of individual states. Governor Roy Cooper's moratorium, which first went into effect in October 2020, is no longer in effect. It would have added another layer of protection by preserving the requirements of the federal moratorium should the CDC order expire. However, the Republican-controlled Council of State rejected his request for renewal the day the earlier SCOTUS decision was handed down, as Policy Watch previously reported. Justices Stephen Breyer, Elena Kagan, and Sonia Sotomayor dissented in the case, writing that the court merely vacated a stay on the eviction moratorium without hearing any oral argument. The three said that the monetary losses claimed by the plaintiffs could still be recovered, as the CDC moratorium requests that tenants pay back their owed rents. They urged the majority to compare the landlord's financial loss to the toll that COVID is taking. The dissent read, "The public interest strongly favors respecting the CDC's judgment at this moment when over 90% of counties are experiencing high transmission rates." Nationwide, only 11% of rental relief has been distributed, and 7 million tenants are relying on the moratorium to shore them up while they wait, according to the National Coalition for a Civil Right to Counsel. In North Carolina, the Delta variant has caused another surge of COVID cases. On August 26th, North Carolina daily new cases topped 8,600 for the first time in months. A month ago, the number was 1,400. Hospitalizations have tripled to exceed 3,500 compared to early July figures. Catherine Sabeth, a law professor at UNC Chapel Hill, called the decision cruel and horrific. Quote, "There are people right now against whom the writ of possession was already issued, and the sheriff is going to go out and throw them in the street now, like right now." She urges judges to step up and help settle the cases through diversion and mediation program. Sabeth maintained that tenants still have their basic rights. It is well established that it's illegal for landlords to lock people out without a court order and a sheriff's execution. The CARES Act has a key provision that requires landlords to give a 30-day eviction notice for housing backed by federal mortgages or subsidies. Tenants can apply for rental assistance to avoid non-payment eviction and seek legal representation in court. A different angle on some housing now by Tomasi McDonald from Durham. Opportunity costs. Coffee importer Timothy Hill and his wife Julie searched 5 years for a home before purchasing a 2,300-square-foot, three-bedroom, red brick house this spring in the Argonne Hills subdivision in North Durham. The neighborhood, with homes built in the late 1960s and early 70s, is chock-full of character. The Hill's backyard features a grape arbor. There's an old black cemetery where grave sites hold the remains of freedmen and women who toiled at the Stagville Plantation, about 10 miles away, before settling in the North Durham community. Hill can leave his screened-in back porch and stroll through Black Meadow Ridge, a sloping, heavily wooded parcel of land, before ending up at West Point on the Eno Park and the Eno River. He wrote in an email to Indy, "A piece of property like this does not exist in Durham anywhere else. There is no public park like this closer to downtown that the city has." Before buying the house, Hill and his wife discovered that a developer with a reputation for building opulent, modernist homes wanted to build a development of 379 single-family homes and townhouses that would cover nearly 60 acres of Black Meadow Ridge, which sits less than 100 feet from their backyard. Tightly packed houses would replace a 10-minute walk through the woods and tree-lined walking trails to the city's flagship park and Eno River, but not before the trees of Black Meadow Ridge are clear-cut, the sloping land's granite foundation blasted away and then graded smooth. Hill felt reassured when he learned that a handful of his new neighbors and the Homeowners Association last year petitioned the city to stop the proposed development. Hill is a reluctant activist who shies away from the spotlight. He knows that the fight to save Black Meadow Ridge has been going on for decades, but now he has joined his neighbors in a fight to stop the home builder from creating what they believe could be an environmental nightmare on the cusp of the city's flagship park. The fate of Black Meadow Ridge could be sealed over the next 2 months when the Durham Board of Adjustment decides whether the public will have a voice in what happens to the serene wooded land that slopes toward the Eno River. How the proposed development came about from the start irks Hill and his neighbors. They say the initial green light for the development was based on nearly a 50-year-old site plans that were incorrectly rubber-stamped in 2016 by a former city council planning director, after a 6-0 city council vote in March of 2012 that called for a comprehensive plan and future land for Black Meadow Ridge as rural, residential, very low density, according to the City of Durham website. Hill says the land was rezoned in 2012 due to environmental concerns and also because it's designated as the highest priority watershed preservation area for the city. The December 2018 Eno River Watershed Assessment Report on the city's website stated that the top source of pollution, as well as a threat to the river's quality and watershed health, is stormwater runoff from impervious surfaces, including roofs, solid decks, patios, sidewalks, driveways, roads, and compacted gravel. Brown's plans to cover Black Meadow Ridge with hard surfaces is troubling, Hill says, especially with the ongoing duress of climate change. Though it's a stunningly beautiful area and people surely would want to live there, it doesn't necessarily mean they should. He says building at a high density with 70% or more impervious surfaces will have huge impacts on the environment and the Eno. It's not a matter of if this area will flood, it's a matter of when and how bad it will be. The city's website shows that local water bodies are less healthy when as little as 10% of an area is covered with impervious surfaces. With natural ground cover, 50% of water runoff seeps into the ground where it is filtered by natural processes before reaching streams and creeks. Severe damage to nearby rivers, streams, and lakes can occur if more than 30% is covered with asphalt, concrete, brick, and other man-made materials. The city also notes that 75% or more of impervious surfaces can exponentially change the way rain moves through the water cycle by increasing pollution that flows into nearby waters, bodies of water, and flooding. Hill adds that flooding at the Eno is already a problem. In 2019, more than 500,000 gallons of raw sewage leaked into the Eno after heavy rainfall. He says, with the Eno River being designated as a water source last year, it is imperative it is protected and more pressure is not added to this fragile area. The proposed development is spearheaded by Keith T. Brown, founder of Point Ridge Park in Chapel Hill. The completed neighborhood will sit along a southern boundary of the West Point on the Eno, which spans roughly 400 acres, once inhabited by the Eno Indians who lived along the river. Over the past 2 years, plans for the development have been met with widely reported objection from nearby residents and their supporters. They point to Brown's success in gaining approval from the city council planning department for the massive project 5 years ago without any public input. A July 2016 letter to Brown from Stephen Medlin, a former city county planning director, confirms the site was granted administrative site plan approval. That's significant because it allows him to undertake the project with no public input. Hill and his neighbors want the Durham Board of Adjustment to require the proposed development to undergo a major site plan review, which would include public notice and public hearing. This is abnormal for any development, Hill says, about the approval of plans that he says are inconsistent and outdated, much less one that impacts the city so greatly. In March of last year, a handful of Argonne Hills homeowners teamed up with the Horton Hills Homeowners Association and the Eno River Association to hire Chapel Hill attorney T.C. Morphis, Jr., who filed an appeal to the BOA. that asked its members to invalidate and reverse in its entirety the 2016 letter issued by Mr. Stephen Medlin and require the proposed development to undergo a major site plan process. Morphis, in the 52-page appeal, claims that Brown is relying on a zoning ordinance created 40 years ago that presumed the construction of Eno Drive, a major highway akin to the 147 freeway that would have run through Black Meadow Ridge and West Point on the Eno Park. The appeal further notes that a proposed 1972 housing development known as Fox Moor was contingent upon the existence of Eno Drive. Fox Moor, which called for 412 units, and Eno Drive was ultimately scrapped owing to, quote, its likely devastating impact on this most environmentally sensitive area of Durham, Morphis stated in the appeal. One of the homeowners listed on the appeal is Christy Benson, an associate professor of business law at Elon University. She says the fight to save the Eno from overdevelopment dates back to 1973 with that proposal to construct Eno Drive. Benson says the project never gained traction thanks in large part to Margaret Nygaard, a legendary activist who known as the mother of the Eno River system. Benson says she came out fighting mad and slowly beat back the proposed Eno Drive. There was a massive public outcry. Last September, lawyers on behalf of Brown and Point Ridge Park countered the homeowner's appeal, filing a motion with the BOA to, quote, exclude the appeal narrative that focused on the development's environmental impact from the affidavit Morphis filed with the board months before. Durham attorneys William J. Bryan and Jeffrey Rother with the Morningstar Law Group argued that while seeking two forms of relief by calling for BOA to reverse the decision and for public input, Morphis's appeal veered off course when he delved into other issues, particularly, quote, the environmental impacts of the development that have no relation to the issues presented. The Durham attorneys did not respond to an email from Indy regarding the legal proceedings. Last month, two workers used an excavator to uproot trees that stretched nearly 3/4 mile and 20 feet wide along the perimeter of Black Ridge Meadow. The broken trees, scattered vegetation, mounds of red dirt, and muddied holes are about 50 yards from the hills and their neighbors' homes. Benson was surprised when she learned the developer was knocking down trees in the neighborhood before the BOA hearings, and said, I thought the city was trying to expand the capacity of stormwater drainage near Stadium Drive. Hill fired a complaint with the city-county planning department. Planning Director Sarah Young, in an email to Indy, says staffers investigated the site after receiving the complaint and found that clearing had occurred without the proper approvals. Young explained that clearing in excess of 12,000 square feet requires a land disturbance permit issued by the County Stormwater and Erosion Control Division. Young also noted the city's Unified Development Ordinance requires a site plan for any development that requires a permit, so the amount of clearing by the excavator without a site plan was also a violation. And Young added, based on these two violations, both the City Council County Planning Department and the County Stormwater and Erosion Division are pursuing enforcement actions. Hill's backyard is less than 12 feet away from the historic, albeit long-neglected, Holman Cemetery, where the few remaining tombstones date back to the 1800s. Officials with Preservation Durham visited Hill's homes after the trees near his backyard were yanked out of the earth and stuck 68 small orange flags in the ground to mark potential grave sites. Hill thinks there may be as many as 80 graves on the site, and of course this is related to the story I just finished. Nicholas Levy, Vice President of Preservation Durham, said in an email to Indy that the gravesite is, quote, an extremely important historic space, one we're just beginning to understand. Given the acute housing shortage in Durham, complaints about construction of new housing in the region seem counterintuitive. But the Black Meadow Ridge advocates say it's not just about opposing home construction. They say the development will destroy nearly 90 acres of woodland that stretches from Roxborough Road to Stadium Drive. Black Meadow Ridge for decades has been home to Eno wildlife, hiking trails, hardwood trees, and ancient granite rock, while serving as a buffer between the city park and their homes. Hill said Black Meadow Ridge will be gone, he said while trampling over land not traumatized by the excavator. Keith Brown, the developer, last week did not return a voicemail left on numbers listed as his cell phone or offices in Chapel Hill. An email sent to addresses listed for Brown were also unanswered. He's a Durham native and NC State University School of Design graduate. In 1984, he founded Sun Forest Systems, a custom design-build firm, 1 year after he graduated from college. In 2000, Brown was named the Carolinas Year's 2000 Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year Award. That same year, Brown was CEO and founder of BuildNet, once described as the darling of Wall Street, before it went bankrupt. An internet search shows that the developer has his own social causes, including an orphanage he co-founded for children in South Africa. Benson and opponents of the development say Brown is trying to push the proposed development through by riding on the coattails of the obsolete Foxmoor development. Benson, citing her work as a business school professor, says she is not inherently anti-development, but we need a more equitable and sustainable base from an environmental standpoint and a historical standpoint, she says. She points to centuries past when the Eno Indians resided in the area and how formerly enslaved people found refuge on the land after the Civil War. She speaks about the white settlers who created the mill village in the deeply wooded area during the pre-colonial era and traded with the Eno tribe. She recalls the importance of the Mangum farmhouse and how the family rose to prominence. She notes how the Eno and Falls Lake continue to provide safe drinking water for residents in Durham, Wake, and Orange County. Now she worries that a fundamental part of Durham's history may be lost. The Eno, she says, encapsulates so much of Durham's soul. Well, let's look at some food and drink. Carrie's eclectic downtown food scene begins to find itself, writes Lena Geller. For some time, Carrie has held the reputation of cruise ship, a self-contained community docked in a corner of the triangle, dominated by corporate sprawl and out-of-towners who occasionally interact with folks in the port of call. But over the past few years, revitalization efforts have begun to help the town shed this image and emerge with its own distinct identity. Carrie's once sleepy downtown area is well on its way to becoming a vibrant, walkable urban center, and independent restaurants are leading the charge. Bond Brothers Beer Company, Pizzeria Faulisi, and Sidebar, three businesses that got in on the ground floor of Carrie's downtown food and beverage scene, opening in 2016, 17, and 18, have each been successfully launched second ventures a few doors down from their individual spots. Now, parenthetically, I'm going to announce that we're 4 minutes and 33 seconds away from the end of our program, and so we've asked Luigi Grampausa to perform again from John Cage's 4 minutes and 33 seconds, and that's what you are not hearing right under us right now. The subtitle for that tune, by the way, 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence. Anyway, to plan, open, and succeed with two concepts inside of 5 years speaks volumes to the enthusiasm the neighborhood and the town have for growth, says the owner of Sidebars and Hanks. That enthusiasm is also driving restaurants based outside Carrie to put down roots there. Scratch Kitchen and Tap Room, which originated in Apex, and DeFara Pizza Tavern, a family-run by-the-slice spot in Brooklyn, New York, both opened a second location in downtown Cary this year. When DeFara co-owner Greg Norton moved to Cary 6 years ago, he was initially unsure whether to go to in construction or expand the restaurant his uncle established in 1965. After seeing how many Northeast transplants live in the town, though, he knew his pizza would be a hit. His only concern? The local water. Norton says, when I make pizzas with North Carolina water, the pizza crust curls up on the edges like a stingray. When I make it with New York water, which is the best water in the world, it comes out perfect every time. It's night and day. At first, Norton thought he'd have to get his relatives to ship him water from New York. I wasn't going to cook the pizza any other way. But then he discovered the New York water maker, a filtration machine that uses a purification process and a mineral concentrate to replicate water from the Catskills. Boom, he says. Problem solved. A few blocks away, another restaurant just opened, but unlike DeFara, this one uses its Cary locale to define its brand, Peck and Plume, which opened in August as the revamped dining room at the Maton, a boutique hotel that was brought out of bankruptcy by local developers in 2020, is decorated to spotlight local flora and fauna, drawing its theme from the seven-acre landscape it will overlook once Cary's downtown park project is completed in 2023. The restaurant's crown jewel is its botanical wallpaper, which poses cardinals and turtle doves against a tangled backdrop of native North Carolina plants. The wallpaper, designed by Hillsboro artist Katie Hayes and produced by the Durham-based company Spoonflower, stands alongside a number of pieces that the Maton commissioned from area artists. The renovation was executed by Early Bird Night Owl. The same management team partnered with the Durham Hotel. Like the restaurant at the Durham, Peck and Plume is chef-driven with a seasonal menu. Built around locally sourced ingredients, though it features more international flavors than its Bull City counterpart, and its dining environment is a tad more casual. Guests can take their plates to the outdoor terrace if they want, or an armchair in the hotel's cozy library. And if the Peck and Plume menu doesn't strike a guest's fancy, the Maton staff won't hesitate to suggest an alternative. If we don't have something they're looking for, right outside our door, there's a lot of great places we can recommend for them to stroll to, says Craig Spitzer, the co-founder of Early Bird Night Owl. Well, folks, as we let 4 minutes and 33 seconds wind down, it's a very exciting performance, calm but exciting. I will just say that John Federson has been reading the Indie Week journal for this week, and it will be available on ncreadingservice.org as a podcast if you care to hear it again. And whether or not we return with a different performance of 4 minutes and 33 seconds next week, I don't know. We'll have to wait to hear the public response. But until next week, John Federson then for ncreadingservice.org says, so long, folks.